Morning. Leptospirosis is a re-emerging zoonotic disease that is transmitted through the urine of infected animals. Recent estimates have suggested that there are about 1 million annual cases worldwide of leptospirosis, of which just about 60,000 result in fatal outcome. Burden is highest amongst males between 20 and 49 years of age. Leptospirosis is an acute febrile illness characterized by the standard symptoms, in most cases, of acute febrile illness listed here, and complications can be severe. Case fatality rate amongst hospitalized patients can be between 5 and 15%. Leptospirosis has been endemic in Puerto Rico and was first documented there in 1942. This is a reportable condition in Puerto Rico. However, there is significant underreporting previously characterized for lepto in Puerto Rico. In 2010, there were 59 cases of leptospirosis reported, of which two were fatal cases. Complicating diagnosis and reporting of lepto is that concurrent lepto-dengue epidemics have been reported in Puerto Rico and elsewhere, and this does confound both clinical diagnosis as well as patient management. We conducted enhanced case finding, non-fatal and fatal, for leptospirosis in 2010 by utilizing cases reported as suspected dengue cases. These cases that were reported but tested negative for dengue were then screened for evidence of leptospirosis. In total, there were 1,950 specimens that were tested, of which 147, or 8%, had laboratory evidence of leptospirosis. For fatal case finding, we collaborated with the Puerto Rico Forensic Sciences Institute and the Vital Registry of Puerto Rico to look for individuals that had evidence of leptospirosis following an acute febrile illness, in most cases postmortem. There were 128 fatal cases identified in 2010 for which diagnostic testing was performed, and of these, 26, or 20%, had diagnostic evidence of leptospirosis. Basic epidemiology of these cases, we first looked at time for these 173 cases in direct correlation with the rainy season in Puerto Rico, which begins in the second half of the year. The majority of cases, non-fatal and fatal, had illness onset in September, October, or November. By age of these 173 cases, we did see lepto cases in all age groups, including one case in an infant. The large majority of cases, however, occurred in adult populations, and nearly all fatal cases occurred in adults. Incidence was highest amongst individuals 40 to 69 years of age. Leptospirosis cases occurred throughout the island. Here you can see the heat map of all cases, and the black dots correlate to fatal cases. Both fatal and non-fatal cases occurred throughout the island in 2010, although incidence was highest in the southeast, as well as in the agricultural rural center of the island, where a number of fatal and non-fatal cases occurred. Overall, the incidence of leptospirosis that was identified was 4.7 cases per 100,000 residents in 2010. In terms of who these individuals were, about 80% of them were male. Many of them were either unemployed or agricultural workers, and there was a large smattering of occupations aside from that. A little bit over a quarter of patients had a known recorded medical or recorded animal exposure in the medical record, of which these were most frequently rats or dogs. In conclusion, we did note a significant underreporting of fatal and non-fatal lepto cases, a 12-fold underreporting of fatal cases, and just about a 3-fold underreporting of non-fatal cases. Therefore, the incidence of lepto in Puerto Rico in 2010 was greater than 4.7 cases per 100,000 residents, demonstrating the need for required reporting, which was initiated nationally in 2012. In data that I didn't have time to show today, we did identify clinical indicators that were associated with fatal outcome at initial clinical visit of fatal lepto cases. And these included decreased sodium bicarbonate with either thrombocytopenia or leukocytosis. So we're hoping these can be utilized in Puerto Rico and potentially elsewhere to identify patients that may be at higher risk for fatal outcome due to lepto. This investigation also demonstrates that leptospirosis patients reflect the need for social justice through public health in Puerto Rico. These are patients that frequently do not have great access to health care and are not being readily diagnosed or managed by lepto. I'd like to acknowledge the individuals that contributed to this investigation, and happy to take any questions, maybe in the session after. Thanks.
And now, in fact, we have about 15 minutes for discussion questions that will be led by Catherine Feldman from the Maryland Department of Health and Mental Hygiene.
Is this on? Can you hear me? Okay, great. We'll now take questions from the audience. If you could line up at the microphone, and if the speakers could come up on stage, and that way we can get as many questions answered as possible. You can hover behind us. I know. As people are gathering, I'll start with the first question. Let's see who's here to take the question. So, Dr. Musgrave, you nicely alluded to the tension between bat conservation and making people aware of the potential risk of rabies from bats, and I'm wondering if you could comment on whether you'd not recommend bat houses on people's properties.
No, I don't think I'd recommend that because I think we all agree, bats have a role to play, and what we have done in Wyoming is try to make some inroads with our Wyoming Game and Fishing Department, and as I mentioned on that one slide, it would have been nice for them to mention issues about bats and what people should do if they wake up in a bat and is in their bedroom, and they now have done that in their materials. So I think there's a way to do this without telling people they shouldn't have bats.
Thank you.
Okay. You could just stay up there because my question's for you as well.
And if you could identify yourself.
Yes,
please.
I'm Carrie Klum. I'm from the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'm our rabies surveillance coordinator. So I was wondering if you could go into the exposure in a little bit more detail, because that's really concerning. We typically think of waking up to a bat in the bedroom as being an exposure, but a low-risk exposure. So, you mentioned it briefly, but did she, have the bat have any physical contact with her, or sort of more detail that?
So what happened, the husband actually woke up first and noticed that a bat was flying around the bedroom, and when he woke up, he actually saw the bat on his wife, and then he woke her up, and she actually brushed the bat off her arm, and he observed her brush the bat off her arm. And then he proceeded to, they both got out a magnifying glass and a light, and they were looking for a bite because they thought that if they couldn't find a bite mark, then it meant that they didn't have to worry about anything. So they did, both report actual contact with the bat.
Thank you all very much for your presentation. I'm Julia Murphy from the Virginia Department of Health. I had a question for Dr. Sharp. Did you say, and maybe I missed it, if I did, I apologize, you said there was an infant, there was one infant who had left, and I was just wondering if, my limitation on my part, I think I'd never thought of babies getting leptospirosis, or what was the risk factor there? Did anybody, do you know, you may not know?
Yeah, so it was recorded in the medical record that the home was infested with rats. So we don't know if there were potentially rats on the baby or the baby crawling through rat urine. We don't really know for a direct exposure.
Okay, so there wasn't a person in the home. There wasn't another, like an adult person in the home who had lepto and anything like that. It was thought that
not
an environmental.
Not diagnosed.
Okay.
So the best guess is that there were rats in the home and somehow the baby got exposed to rat urine.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, I'm Diane Willard from the Virginia Department of Health, and my questions are out of pure ignorance. One is on the TB. I wonder if you could explain how the ingestion pathway can result in pulmonary TB.
Well, I'm not. I'm actually not a clinician or a real expert in TB, but I know that ingestion typically, the disease is extrapulmonary, but it can Excuse me.
Was the disease extrapulmonary?
No, in this person, it was respiratory disease, and it was just our best guess that it could have been from ingestion. But he also had exposure to cattle in Mexico, and some cases from ingestion can become pulmonary, but it's not common. It's not as common as extrapulmonary.
It's hard for me to understand how that would work. Do you, Al?
When you inhale TB organisms, they first go to the lymph nodes in the hilum and around the lung, and then they get disseminated into the bloodstream, and that's how they get to the apices of the lung and cause cavitary disease. So presumably when you ingest them, it's that bacteremic period that seed the lungs and cause the infection after they sort of pass through the lymphatics.
Thank you.
The
other question was on the leptospirosis. I wonder if you could explain the association with the rainy season. I was thinking with exposure to urine, the rain would wash it away or dilute it out, but it seems like it's the opposite.
Yeah, it's usually the opposite. So many people, certainly not all, but many will have exposure to standing water or to rivers or to lakes. So if you can imagine that there are rats kind of hanging out next to a river, you get more rain. The rain then, you know, increases the water level in the river, and then if people are swimming in that river, so the rain can effectively liberate the leptospires that can hang out for, in some cases, months in soil.
Thank you.
Sure.
Moderators have some questions. No, it's really on. It seems to be on. Brian. Actually, there are two questions. I think Catherine had a question for you, and then I have a question. But for state and local health departments who may not have the expertise capacity or want to have some experts from the federal level to help out, because M. bovis is not the usual. Obviously, it's not tuberculosis. And I know, having called over the at CDC tuberculosis folks, you know, about atypical mycobacteria, they're kind of like, well, no, that's not really our realm. So I'm kind of curious, if we were to call over to CDC, would they help us with M. bovis? I noticed that the specimens for testing actually went to the USDA as opposed to CDC. So I thought if you could comment a little bit on that.
Yeah, we, well, first of all, I'm a career epidemiology field officer assigned in Nebraska full time, so that's why I was there. We made an effort to actually write this up in an MMWR to demonstrate that this was an unusual situation with M. bovis, but it did add to the knowledge base to suggest that it could be airborne. And with the first case, our TB program actually was kind of limited in their response when they learned that it was M. bovis, you know, kind of working on the assumption, well, it's not really that infectious, so we're not going to worry about it. You know, not quite that simple, but then when we had the second case, the stakes really went up. And the reason that we sent it to USDA is because we wanted to have a comparison with their animal isolates. And we had some TB, Mycobacterium bovis TB in beef herds in Nebraska, but we hadn't had it in dairy herds since 1978. So we wanted to be very clear that we were able to match it to isolates of cattle if we could to make sure that it wasn't coming from cattle in Nebraska, first of all, and then to be able to try to map it to maybe a location. In this case, we were able to show that it was closely related to isolates in Mexico.
So as a follow-up question, would there discussion about the potential for this individual to transmit to animals and introduce it into Nebraska?
Yeah, he had actually worked in a dairy for the first 2 years when he came here, but of course wasn't having symptoms or infectious at that time. And we, this overwhelmed the local health department. So we did our best to learn as much as we could about animals and potential, reverse zoonoses, if you will. Most of these people actually worked. A lot of the it was this mainly Hispanic population. Most of them worked in a layer facility that was affected by high path avian influenza. So, you know, we ended up with not so many people that were working around cattle. But it was concerning, and I worked really closely with the ag, our Department of Ag, to make sure that they were aware of this. But we didn't learn of any people that at least reported exposure, you know, ongoing contact with cattle. So.
Thank you. I have a question for Chelsea. So you indicated that the cats, there were fewer cats when you went back. And was there an attempt to actually trap the cats and remove them from the community? And if so, what was the reaction in the community?
This is a difficult question.
Yeah.
it got a little contentious because people like cats. And so we kind of took our hands off of that. We put pressure on the property management to enforce their rules, and we educated the residents as best we could, and we're not really sure why it went down, but it was just based on our observations that we were pleased to see that was the result. But I guess I can't really answer that. We're not sure. We just did our best. We educated and let the situation deal with itself, and that seemed to work.
Can I add one thing? You asked me about the support that we got from CDC, and we did get excellent support from CDC. I came back. Not just me, because going into this, I was not a TB expert, and I'm still not. But we collaborated very heavily with CDC and sought guidance on everything from clinical care to management. So I would be remiss if. The Division of Tuberculosis Prevention Event, yeah, they did. Yeah, and John Jarob was a co-author on the paper.
So, my question is for Kelsey. Coming from a state, I don't think it works.
Can everybody hear, Sarah?
No. It is working? All right. So, coming... Is it? I think we have to be right on top of it. Coming from a state, Hawaii, where we do have murine typhus, I'm curious because, of course, time constraints, you weren't probably able to go into the your threshold for how you determined someone was a case or not. You mentioned using serology. We know from our experience it's not so easy to just say, oh, yeah, by serology. So I was curious, were you actually successful in getting an S2, or did you just use the S1 and use a probable criteria, or what was your parameter for calling a case?
Our case definition was based off of the California Department of Public Health murine typhus definition. There were some borderline serologies, but because of the they were residents of the mobile home community, we had that EpiLink, and that was probable, but then we classified them as confirmed because of that EpiLinkage, but it was based on the CDPH definition.
Any other questions? I'll finish up with a rabies question. Bring Carl back up. End out the question session. So we struggle, as everybody does, with increasing awareness of bats and the potential for rabies. So I'm just wondering if you have any, since you have this recent experience of trying to raise awareness among Wyoming providers, Wyoming public, do you have any words of advice for Maryland and others of us who want to get the word out?
Well, yeah, if you want to raise awareness about rabies in your state, one way to do it is to have a death. So we did get a lot of media coverage, and also we did get a lot of interest from these other agencies like Game and Fish now that we, because, they'd always said, you don't have to worry about it because we've never had a human death in Wyoming, and now that we had one, they stepped up and paid more attention. So.
Okay, well, we'll leverage Wyoming's death and try not to have any anywhere else. I guess my final question then is for Tyler. I'm just curious if there were any other interesting exposure to rat stories. You mentioned rat-infested houses. Were there any other more overt rat bites or anything else like that?
Rat bites, no. Lots of stories. Of these 173 cases, I reviewed the medical records for probably 160 of them. There's a lot of stories that are in there. One that comes to mind is a guy who owned a gallero, a cock farm for raising chickens for fighting. And he noticed one day that there was kind of a rapid presence of rats, most of which were dead, in his gallero, in the area where they were all cooped up. So he thought a good idea would be just to go clean them all up. And so he just grabbed them up, and then, he had open sores on his hands at the time, had no awareness of lepto whatsoever. Three or four days later, he came down with stomach flu, and 2 days later, he was dead. So, some of these stories, they're kind of interesting and maybe a little, amusing in terms of, how people get exposed. But, lepto, when it comes down to it, is really a horrible disease. It's a terrible way to die that no one should suffer through. So, sorry to put that kind of heavy spin on it, but...
Okay, and with that, we'll move on to the second part of this session. Thank you.